Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
United Armies of the Spoilerverse, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenneth Regan. That is Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, well, it's Dave McKean, isn't it?
It is. This is cool, man, because I'm a big fan of this guy's work. Dave is an amazing illustrator, man.
Yeah, so tell us something that everybody's going to know about, but might not know that he did every single one.
Well, he worked on a book called The Big Fat Duck Cookbook.
Okay, now you're fucking with me.
No, I mean, he really did.
But
no,
I believe that, you know I'm talking about something else. You're purposely ignoring.
No, he did the covers for New Game and Sandman series.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, man. It is. That series has become a stuff of legend.
It has. I was going through my comics recently, and I have 1 through 75, and I was looking at them again. I was like, man.
Don't you have like an ultra rare version of one of them?
So, yeah, I have the editorial version number 8, the first Prince of Death. There's only like 500 of them.
The editorial version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a what happened is to get the copyright out is they printed like a New Gaiman talked about it on Twitter one time recently, but they printed a version, a quick run with an inside cover had an editorial from Karen Berger on it, and they run it off like 500 copies to get it in print. Mm-hmm. And then they did the full run, which had a different letter in the front page, not from Karen Berger. So there's that verse, two verses. They look the exact same. The only difference really you can tell is inside cover has a different editorial on it.
Oh, it's interesting though. It's kind of cool that you have one.
Yeah, my dad bought it for me. We were at a show and he knew I wanted one. He found one at in Oregon down at when they used to do the Second Genesis shows.
Yeah.
And he bought it for me.
That's cool. Those dads, man. Sometimes they do the right things. Right?
Sometimes.
So Dave McKean stopped by, sat down with Melissa, and they had a conversation. So should we sit back and relax and hear what they have to say?
Let's do it.
This is Spoiler Country, and I'm Melissa Sercha. Today on the show, I'm excited to welcome award-winning illustrator, comic book artist, photographer, and filmmaker, Dave McKean. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Very nice to be here.
Yes. Well, it's nice to have you. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
That's fine.
Perfect. So I'd love to know, in your career, you've utilized many different mediums artistically. In the beginning, what was the one that got you started?
Well, it depends what you mean by the beginning. When I was very young, I was drawing all the time. I can't remember a time when I wasn't drawing. Mm-hmm. So that was just drawing with whatever came to hand, really. But then I fell in love with comic books when I was about 8.
Oh, wow.
And so, I wanted to draw like that, really. So I wanted to draw with, black line drawings. And then when I went to art school, just everything changed because there's a world of, you're introduced to a world of different possibilities. So I tried painting, drawing and photography and printmaking and filmmaking and everything opened up then.
That's great. Now, how did you meet Neil Gaiman and what inspired you to start working together?
I was still in art school. I had made some comics with a couple of friends of mine there who were also fans, and we made four issues of a comic called Meanwhile together, and they were seen by some editors in London, and so I ended up working on actually a magazine that never happened in the end. It was called Borderline. There was a group of people working on it, and many of them have gone into being professional writers and illustrators, and one of them was Neil, and he was writing I think, two or three of the stories. I was writing and illustrating two of the stories. And during the editorial meetings, we'd all get together once a month and show each other what we'd been doing. And we just got talking and like what each other was doing. And then Neil had written a story called Violent Cases. He was in a writer's workshop at the time and gave it to me to read. And I thought it would make a good book. And the dominoes carry on falling from there.
Yeah, rest is history.
Yeah.
So you also illustrated Arkham Asylum, which was written by Grant Morrison. It's considered the most successful graphic novel of all time. How did you two approach that book creatively, and why do you think it still resonates today?
Well, I think the script had been hanging around a while. I certainly wasn't the first person to be sent it. And I've never really been, certainly as an adult, not much of a superhero fan. Mm-hmm. But I thought there was some interesting stuff in it, in the writing. But I really needed to talk to Grant about it. So I got together with Grant for lunch. And we were both at a similar point, I think, where we both wanted to try new things and bring in other influences to what we were doing. We both liked writers like Dennis Potter, and we both liked strange films, Jan Švankmajer's animations and things like that. And we wanted to bring in some of those influences. And I think we fancied doing something that wasn't just a straight Batman story or superhero story, something that was more of an expressionistic story or a dream or a nightmare. And so it just developed from there, really. And it was at a wonderful time in mainstream comics where we had a lot of leeway, and they were very happy for us to experiment and just try new things. I'm not sure that book could really be done now.
Yeah.
Because everything has clamped down a lot more. But at the time, it was very open editorially. So we were free to play.
That's great. So you had a lot of creative freedom then.
We had almost complete creative freedom, really.
Wow. That probably made the experience special in itself.
It was a very enjoyable year. I really enjoyed trying new things and pushing it as far as I felt we could take it without breaking it completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, you've done so many interesting things. I want to touch a little bit on as much as I can. We have time allots. But you designed projections also for Lestat, the Broadway musical. What was that like? And was Anne Rice involved in that at all?
Strange one for you to pick. Again, as a sort of working experience, it was mostly great fun. I was working with some of the best Broadway technicians, projection people, lighting people, costume people. It was amazing having Bernie Taupin around. Elton John was only around a couple of times, but Bernie Taupin was there all the time.
Wow.
He was wonderful. He was really on top of it, desperately trying to make it as best as he could. I never met Anne Rice. I don't even know whether she saw it.
Okay.
And in the end, honestly, it was dreadful and deserved to close after 5 or 6 weeks.
Okay.
And there were reasons why it was so bad, but they were out of my hands, really. And from my side of it, which was about creating images on stage, and initially it was about projections and various things, I had a great time doing it.
Great. Yeah, it sounded like it would be a fun project to work on with just a lot of different things you could explore.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a shame at the end of it when you feel like you've come away with nothing but the experience. It would be nice if it had been a better piece, or if it had lasted a bit longer. But in the end, it was one of life's... You have to chalk these things up to experience. But as an experience of doing it, it was good.
It was fun, yeah. Well, and you've also created CD covers for artists, you know, Tori Amos, Counting Crows, just to name a few. So how does that differ when you're creating a CD cover from the process of creating a book cover?
Well, you get to listen to the music, for starters. And the thing about music is it's an emotional response. It just goes straight in. You don't have to work out what the plot is or, you know, what the writer is trying to say. You put on the music and you immediately start to see images and colors and ideas. And so I love that about music, that I can spend a day even doing music that I wouldn't normally listen to, but you have an emotional response to it. So that's great. Doing a book cover is much more involved. You've got to read the book. You've got to get into it and try and come up with something that suggests the book without just putting a picture from this, you know, a scene of the book on the cover. That's very boring.
Yeah.
You have to come up with something that's a sort of window into the atmosphere or the style of the book, or what the author's trying to say. So that's rather more involved
Okay. Just, yeah, set the tone for the album, I guess.
Yes.
Awesome. Yes. And so did that influence you at all to find, you founded a record label, Feral Records, and what kind of music do you produce? And did that have any, the album covers have any influence on your decision to get into that?
Well, I love music. I mean, I play music. So music's been a big part of my life since I was a kid. That was my big life choice, really, to pursue professionally music or art. And I tried to keep the two in balance as long as I could, but then just got very busy as an illustrator, and the music had to be for just personal, really. But recently I've got back to it and bringing in music into the films that I've been making and performance pieces, so that's been great. But I love jazz, and I have a good friend, Ian Ballamy, and we've done a lot of things together now, and he was looking for a home, so we thought we'd start a label for basically pretty avant-garde Scandinavian jazz. It's a very niche audience. I think we know most of the people who bought our albums personally, but I love the records. We've only done a handful. I think we've released 9 albums now, but I love the music, and I've been really enjoying creating the packaging. The first one was for Ian's band called Food, and we did a box with postcards and all sorts of things in the box. But we also put a little twist of pasta in some of the boxes.
Oh, cool.
Or a bay leaf or a dry chili. And we got a great review from somebody who said that they really loved the music. And if you buy 50, 60 copies, you get a free meal for 2 out of it as well.
I love that. That's a great idea. So you're also, I mean, there's so many things. You're a talented photographer. You have several photography books out. How has photography shaped your perspective and your view as an artist when you're drawing?
Well, I started playing with photography in art school. I still take reference photographs all the time. And I still, every time I travel, I take lots of photographs and have a sort of huge library of images that I draw on for covers and whatever they're needed for. So photography is just bound into my process, really. And more recently, well, I say recently, in the last 10, 12 years, I've tried to get away from having so much of a sense of the photograph in the drawings and paintings that I make, which has left a sort of nice hole for photography to be its own thing. It's not just part of my process in creating a painting. It's its own thing. So I've done photography exhibitions and published 4 books, and I'm working on another one now. And the more I do it, the more I'm happy for it just to be, for the photographs just to be photographs. They're not trying to look like illustrations or looking like surreal images. They're just the images that I take, the photographs that I take of places, okay. A lot of birds at the moment. And it's, you know, part of my image bank.
Okay. Do you do color and black and white?
I do, you know, whatever's needed, really. I shoot everything in color. But the books that I've done, the first 2 were black and white or duotone, 2 color, sepia color. And the more recent ones have been in full color.
Oh, very nice. And speaking of that, you've also won multiple James Beard Awards for the Fat Duck Cookbook and Historical Heston. Yes. So how did you get involved in that? And have you always been interested in working with food artistically?
Well, I've always enjoyed food, but I got involved with working with Heston Blumenthal through my publisher, a children's book publisher.
Okay.
We're both at Bloomsbury Press, and he was looking to produce his first cookbook for the Fat Duck. And he loves Alice in Wonderland. That's one of the major texts in his imagination.
Oh, cool.
He wanted his book to have a children's book, fantastical Alice in Wonderland feel to it. So he asked his editor to give him some children's books to try and find a collaborator. And he liked mine. He liked a book I did called Wolves in the Walls with Neil Gaiman. And so I met him. We immediately got on. I immediately knew what he was doing. I just had an absolute simpatico feel with him of what he was trying to achieve. And I did some mock-up illustrations that I thought would be the sorts of things we could do with the book. And he immediately liked those. And we just got on ever since. We're still working together. We've done 2 huge books. And I've done murals for the restaurants and package design for the different restaurants. But I've also designed the narrative element. My official title is Director of Story, Fat Duck, because there is a whole narrative element to your lunch or evening meal that you have there. It's not, you can't just show up and have burger and chips. You've got to sit down for 4 or 5 hours and be taken into this world. And there's a narrative, strong narrative component, and we deliver those through props and flavors and food combinations, and also the stories that sort of encourage out of the diners by the waiters. Mm-hmm. So it's very complicated, but it's a completely unique experience.
That sounds really fascinating. So can anybody just go in? Do you have to have a reservation? Is it a restaurant where, you know, you need to book 3 months in advance, that kind of a thing?
Yes, you need a reservation. If you want a weekend, if you want a Saturday evening, yes, you probably have to book 3 months in advance, and you'd be lucky to get a table.
Yeah.
But if you want a weekday lunch, you know, give them 3 weeks, you'll probably get a table.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the sort of place, you know, you go to once in a lifetime, really. And many people, because it's a legendary place now, it's one of the very best restaurants in the world, people save up to go and have a very, very special time there. And because he personalizes the experience so much,
right?
When you book, you're encouraged to talk to the reception staff and they ask you various questions and tease out bits of information about you booking it, or if there's a birthday involved, then the whole experience becomes very, very personal. And we've had some extraordinary experiences there.
That's awesome. Now, do you find, because of your work with that, have you been approached by other restaurateurs wanting you to help them with their menus and promotion?
I have been asked to do a couple of other things. They've never really been as good, though. They've always been just, you know, adding a few pretty pictures to something that's already there. It's not the same as working with Heston, where I really feel embedded in the process now.
Right.
And there's a restaurant not far from me. It's a Mexican restaurant, and I've done all their images and menus and postcards. But that's been an old favorite of mine, and I started going there, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, and they're still using all my stuff. So that's the only other sort of special one.
Okay, so it's more like a neighborhood place that you feel a kinship to.
It is. That you can just drop in there anytime and look at my posters on the wall.
Nice. Well, I'd have to, I have to talk about Mirror Mask, because the guys at Spoiler Country would, kill me if I didn't. What inspired you and Gaiman to create Mirror Mask, and, how did you conceptualize it?
It was an opportunity, really. Lisa Henson, who is Jim Henson's daughter, was producing, and she had a two-picture deal with Sony. And one of the films was a Muppet film, so that was all taken care of. But the other film, they talked about trying to make another fantasy film in the spirit of Jim Henson's Labyrinth, Dark Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a tiny budget. They had something like a 20th of the budget of those films to play with, and they weren't sure how they could possibly do that. But Lisa had already knew Neil, because I think they'd been kicking around the idea of adapting Neverwhere, so they were already talking. And then Lisa had seen my short films that were at various film festivals, mm-hmm. that I made for literally nothing. And so she thought maybe the two of us could cook up something with, Neil's established name as a fantasy writer and my ability to turn the sorts of images that I was making as illustrations into moving pictures. So we took 2 weeks out. We had a little window of opportunity where we could pitch our idea to Columbia before it all went away. So it was Columbia TriStar, which is part of Sony.
Okay.
And so we took 2 weeks. We spent 2 weeks together in Lisa's house in Hampstead, and wrote a script from scratch. We both brought ideas to the table. We both brought scenes to the table and ideas for what it could be. I brought some music and I brought some books of images to look at. And every day we just wrote scenes and then slowly, well, actually rather quickly, put it all together. And at the end of the 2 weeks, we had a script and handed it over. And what I expected them to say was, good. Okay, it's got some interesting stuff in it. Now that you've proved that you've got some interesting stuff, go away for 3 months and write it properly, and then come back. But actually what they said was, great, let's do that. And they wrote us a check. And so we were in shock, really, and we didn't want to jinx it. So we got
it. Doesn't happen often.
That never happens. Yeah. So, but actually what it would have been much better, really, to take those 3 months and say, okay, what in here is working and what could be stronger? And there's an awful lot of it that I think could have been stronger.
Right, but it does have quite a cult following. It's very popular.
Does it? Okay. I come upon the occasional person who tells me that they like it, but I haven't really noticed that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have to ask you about one aspect in your creative process for it. You hand drew thousands of fish. Why did you decide to do that by hand?
I didn't do that. Where did you get that from?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I got a bad source.
there was one hand-drawn sequence, a little story within a story, but they were sort of 2D, 3D animated. They weren't hand-drawn. It wasn't hand-drawn animation, so to speak. It was all 3D animation, really.
Okay.
Although I did design it all, and I did do lots of storyboards, hundreds of storyboards, I didn't draw anything directly in.
Okay. So do you tend to, when you're doing a film, I mean, I guess because of the process of it, you use mostly like computer, you know, graphics, essentially?
Yes. Well, yes, it was computer graphics, but done, made to look handmade. That's what I wanted it. That's the feel that I wanted it to have. I wanted it to look like my illustrations, which are handmade. I still draw and paint everything. So rather than that very slick photographic photoreal look that most CG has, yep, I just wanted the textures to feel like paintings or rust or wood or, you know, handmade objects.
Yeah, well, and I think that definitely resonates because the visuals are very unique. You know, it doesn't look like every other, you know, film that's out there. So I think you achieved that.
part of it was budgetary. It's cheaper to do that rather than do photoreal stuff because that's very processor intensive, takes a lot of time, so it therefore takes a lot of money. But also it comes out of the script. The idea was that the young girl, Helena, at the centre of it, drawn this city on her wall. So it was scraps of paper and little paintings and little bits of collage scattered all across her wall, and that was the city. So when you actually enter that city, it should still have that handmade, hand-drawn quality,
that feel to it. Yeah, definitely. And a lot of your work centers around fantasy and the esoteric. Are those themes that you've always been drawn to?
No, not really. And I really don't like the fantasy label anymore. And I was always a bit wary of it, but now I really don't like it at all. Not because there isn't a fantastical element to what I do, or an imaginative element or dreamlike element. There certainly is. But I'm not interested in stories that are just fantasy worlds unrelated to the real world.
Okay.
Stories about monsters and elves and fairies and ghosts, I really am not interested in. But stories about the way that we interpret the world and the dreams that we have about the world and the feelings that we have about the world that could be expressed in imaginative or dreamlike or, you know, slightly fantastical ways, then absolutely, that's my realm. But I'm really not interested in pure fantasy.
Okay. Well, let's talk about one of your newer works, your graphic novel Raptor, published by Dark Horse. What can you tell us about the story? Is it a standalone or the beginning of a new series?
I've set it up to be potentially some kind of series. It would be at most, it would be a sort of series of standalone stories, but featuring the same character. I wanted a character who represents me, really, trapped in this place between two worlds, the world of dream and the imagination and fantastical imagery, but also reality, just everyday stories about things that affect us all, growing up, growing, aging, dealing with grief, dealing with birth, dealing with becoming a parent, dealing with, you know, all of these things that affect us all. These are the things that I'm fascinated by, but I want to find ways of looking at these subjects through a different lens. So this character is sort of trapped between the state of a bird-like state, a bird of prey-like state, and a human-like state. And he makes his living hunting creatures in a sort of fantastical realm. But he, all the time, he seems to be in touch with people in our real world. And so the story takes place in two places. One of them is this sort of strange fantastical realm, and one of them is late 19th century Wales, where a Welsh horror writer has lost his wife and in a state of grief, trying to see her again in a world beyond ours. Actually, he doesn't think it exists, and I don't either, but that in the state of grief that he finds himself, that's what he desires. He wants there to be a place beyond this right. world where he can see his wife again.
Okay. And is this book available now to purchase?
No, it's published next year.
Next year. Okay, wonderful. Have the pre-orders started?
I think it's only just been announced, so I doubt it. It's okay. Only just...
So this is really fresh. Okay, perfect. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it. And then I want to ask too about your stuff is so, like you said, dreamlike. And I'm curious about the different places that you draw inspiration from. Is there a specific sort of source that you find yourself always returning to when you're looking for, you know, a specific inspiration?
Well, it depends what it is. If it's my own stories, they tend to come from just things that I've become obsessed with, and those things are real life things that happened to me or friends of mine. So I made a film called Luna, which was about a couple losing a baby and dealing with that. And I made a graphic novel recently called Black Dog, The Dreams of Paul Nash, which is about an artist called Paul Nash, British artist, who was a war artist. And his experience of the First World War fundamentally changing him as a person and discovering himself. It's full of sort of fantastical images and works, you know, imaginative ideas, but it's very much based in the real world. So those are the things that inspire me. But then when it comes to, you know, finding images, whether it's for an album cover or a book cover, it comes out of whatever that source material is. So it's listening to the music or reading the text. Something in there will tell me what that image needs to be.
And for your own stuff, as we call it, dreamlike, do you ever actually get inspiration from dreams? Like, have you had a dream that's woken you up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, I need to write that down?
Very rarely, really. I've managed to sort out my dreams in waking life, I think. So I tend not to dream that much. But occasional ones have really struck me. And Raptor comes out of one that hung around for a long time. I woke up one morning, you know, in that feeling that there's something really awfully wrong, and it was actually there was a cloud over my head. I just couldn't shake it, and it was sourced in the dream that I'd had that night, which was about my wife being two people, and I loved both of them, and they were different. They were different aspects of her, and I loved them both because they're both. I woke up with a feeling that I had to choose between them. Of course, I didn't in real life. And it really struck me. And I felt really low all day. And I kept on having to remind myself that it was just a dream and I had no reason to feel like this. So a lot of those feelings went into the source.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's amazing how dreams can stick with you for a while. You know, it's amazing what our subconscious, you know, stores.
It is. Another idea has sourced another story that I'm writing at the moment, or another dream sourced another story, because it's very hard. It was a very strong emotional dream I had a long time ago, and the feeling in it really struck me because it was quite frightening. I woke up knowing that I killed somebody, and I haven't killed anybody, but it was absolutely profound feeling that I'd done that. And then you start to think, what really is the difference between this deep knowledge from this dream that I'd killed somebody and actually having killed somebody?
Right.
What is the real difference? I mean, there'd be a missing person, but if that person was never missed by anybody and is just lying in the ground somewhere, and it's really morbid thought, I realise, but it was really quite a strange nagging thought, what is the fundamental difference between the two? So that's sort of another story that I'm writing at the moment.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, when you mentioned that, it reminds me of just some of the philosophical, you know, quandaries that we've studied over the years, and just that whole concept of what is consciousness, really.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in the way people think, and for example, what it takes to change your mind. This, I think it's really interesting at the moment how embedded many people are in a bunker of thinking, and confirmation bias just beds them down in that particular mode of thought, and there's just no way of them looking through somebody else's eyes or looking at the argument a different way, or even considering that not only might they not be completely correct, but they might be fundamentally wrong about something. So I also want to write a story that deals with that. What does it take to change?
And would that be kind of relating to modern times and the way society is right now?
Would absolutely be related to that, because I've never known a more polarized time than we've been at the moment. I'm sure there have been other times like this, and I'm sure that people have always had conversations like this, but the structures that bed us into this bunker of thought at the moment seem to be so strong. I think social media and the internet is a real problem at the moment. There are lots of amazing things about the internet, but the negatives are really powerful, and we're only just starting to really deal with them. And I think it's a really strange and crucial time at the moment, and I want to write something about it. It seems urgent to write something about the times we're living in.
Yeah, well, and when the concept, you know, of truth is sort of at risk, you know, because there doesn't seem to be any like general universal truth. It's just what everybody else wants to perceptual, you know, truth in their minds.
Yeah, I think it's because, I mean, there's several reasons, but I think one of them is that the media that we take our sense of the world from used to be pretty much a single story. Yes, it was slanted slightly to the left or slightly to the right or slightly from one angle or another, but there was a basic consensus of what reality was, and you wrote about that reality from your particular slant. But now that's been dismantled and discredited. You know, in England we have BBC, and I'm still a huge fan of the BBC. They get a lot wrong, but they're huge and complicated corporation, and they're bound to make mistakes, but essentially I think they do an extraordinary job, and the fact that they're constantly criticized from both sides as being irretrievably right-wing or irretrievably left-wing means to me that they're probably doing something about right. You know, they're balancing in the middle, they're about right. But many people now refuse to listen to that sort of central narrative. Even if you disagree with it, you are aware of it. They just are unaware of it. They will only take their information from sources that agree with what they already think. And that's really dangerous, I think.
Absolutely. You know, and here in the US, we have, you know, the sort of dueling news teams like Fox and CNN. And you mentioned you have the BBC in the UK. Is there another big famous, you know, news source that sort of like goes against what the BBC puts out?
No, the television sources are generally not bad. There's Al Jazeera and a few others are good. It's the press who are appalling. The press are all owned by billionaire, you know, non-dom, ultra-right-wing, ultra-capitalist owners, the Murdochs of this world. And, you know, if anybody's responsible for the destruction of public discourse, it's the press in this country. There's a couple of papers who are still independent, and I read them. And I try and read the others as well, so I have a sense of what they're saying, but it's deeply depressing.
Yes, yeah, and it is hard to know if what you're reading is correct, you know, a lot of the times. I mean, you know, you have your valuable news sources, but there's just so much misinformation out there. And for people that might not know how to sift through that, you can see how dangerous, you know, that could be.
Yes. And so, I mean, I think you can only reach some sense of reality from a consensus. You should never take all your information from one source. Mm-hmm. You should be across many sources, actually as many sources as you can stand. And somewhere in amongst all that, you'll start to see elements of this. It's like overlapping, you know, lattices of story. There are bits that are inescapably true that start to build up a sense of solidity, and the other stuff is just either blatantly untrue or an angle that is clearly very, very slanted one way or the other. But the essence of the story, you know, starts to appear many, many times across these different sources. So that's the best thing to do, really. Read as many sources as possible and try and read, you know, suck it up and try and read things that you know you'll disagree with, so you have a sense of what the opposing argument is.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. Now, do you feel that this climate and the pandemic has affected you at all as an artist creatively?
Well, I mean, obviously it's affected me in terms of being aware of it. I check in, read the paper every morning, and watch a news bulletin every evening. So I have a sense of what's going on. And obviously it's appalling. I have many friends who are having a really tough time. Mm-hmm. Elderly people or indeed elderly people, and or looking after children or looking after themselves if they're not very well, or working in the front line of the medical profession. And I have friends who've had it. Fortunately, I don't know anybody who's died of it. I know some people who've had some really tough times having caught it. So it's obviously out there, and it's a concern. It's on, you know, it's in your mind all the time. Yeah. But I live in the middle of nowhere, so I'm very lucky. I live a basically self-isolated life anyway. I had a year's worth of work set up, books and a couple of exhibitions and things. So I've just been cracking on with that, really, and I think that's all you can do. I don't want to spend my life online and watching the news and dwelling on it, because then I just do nothing at all.
Right.
So I try and decompartmentalize my day and spend a bit of time every day just making getting a sense of what's going on in the world, but then just try and put it to one side and get on with my work.
Yeah, I know, because the internet can be a creative zapper just in itself.
It can, yeah. I mean, I really think it's mostly a waste of time. I don't really do any social media. Because I really don't see the value of it. I don't think Facebook and Twitter is a place to get into any kind of serious debate. Ignore it now.
And another thing I wanted to ask you about: many artists struggle with imposter syndrome, even sometimes after achieving success. Is that something you've ever experienced?
That's really strange. A lot of people seem to be talking about imposter syndrome these days. Maybe it's a coronavirus. I can't say I do a lot. I've always had this. When I started, I remember simultaneously thinking, why would anybody give me a job? Because there are so many terrific illustrators around. Why would the chance, a complete newcomer, fresh out of art school, why would anybody give me a job? Well, but simultaneously thinking, well, I can do better than that. You know, I see so many things that are just dreadful to me, and I'm sure I can do better than that. So I always had a sort of slightly arrogant side and a slightly I'm not worthy, I'll never get a job side. And I've managed to sort of keep those two personalities going. But generally now I feel reasonably secure with what I can do, what I can't do, where my weaknesses are, where my strengths are. And I'm much more focused on attention to the things that I really can do and stand a chance of doing well, rather than wasting time on stuff that I think is trivial or doesn't use my skills well, or actually that I'm just no good at.
Right. Would you say that you, because I've heard different methods of doing it, are you one that likes to sort of create when inspiration strikes, or do you create a routine for yourself where you get up every day at a certain time and say, okay, these hours of the day I'm going to work on projects?
What seems to work for me is to have quite a structured day, quite a structured life, really. But within that structure, the periods of time where that I've set aside to work on things, totally chaotic. I have no idea where they're going to go, what they're going to be, or what I'm going to end up doing. But so long as I can do that within quite a structured day, it seems to work really well. I get a lot done.
Okay, awesome. Now, and what advice would you give to artists that are coming up and want to, you know, have a career such as yourself? What advice would you give to them?
Definitely don't do that. I've no idea really, because the world is so different now from the one that I started in. There was no internet when I started. It was barely digital. I was established before I bought a computer, my first computer in 93. Mm. So the world has changed completely. There, in some areas, the work that you could do as a beginning illustrator or designer or whatever just doesn't exist anymore. Whereas other areas have popped up, and there's brand new openings and possibilities for showing the work that weren't around when I was starting. So it's very difficult to say, really. I think probably the main thing is that advice I would give anybody is prioritize your own personal work. It's very easy to either get lost in the thought of what other people want and trying to put portfolios together of what you think will be successful or what you think other people want. And then when you start to get jobs, feel that you need to just keep on feeding that, and your own work tends to be shuffled down the schedule because it's not necessarily immediately making money for you, or, you know. But that, I think that's a real mistake. I think you really have to prioritize your own work in your life. Because in the end, that's the work that you'll feel most satisfied with and will give you the most feedback, nourishment, as it were. And also, anything that you do that is worth a damn, that you have a real passion for, will eventually pay you back, actually pay you back. People will see it and say, that's wonderful. Will you do something like that for us? So prioritize your own work.
Okay. That's good advice. Really good. Really good advice. Well, and finally, before we go, I just wanted to ask you one question, and this might be a hard one to answer, or maybe not. But looking back to, you know, when you first started till now, what's some of the most, you know, the important lesson that you've learned?
Well, apart from that one of, you know, making sure that I pay attention to what I want to do, my own voice, not getting stuck in a stylistic rut, that's important. It would have been very easy to carry on doing sort of painted superhero books because the first ones that I did were so successful. But that's so obviously a dead end. Mm-hmm. And so obviously something that I would just get bored of and locked into, I had to get away from it immediately. So that's why I did a book called Cages, which is almost the complete opposite of that. It's very simple black line drawings. I wrote it, not a superhero in sight. And it's just a book that I really wanted to exist. So that's an important one. What else? Starting things and finishing things is always good. I tend to be very bad at making plans and not getting around to actually starting them. But you must do that. You must just start things. And then once started, it's very easy to get sidetracked and, you know, you have the first five pages of your great novel stuck in a drawer for years. Mm-hmm. You must finish those things. Because actually, rather than, you know, worrying about each piece of work being perfect and summing you up as an individual, what actually sums you up in the end is your body of work. So by starting things and finishing things and accumulating the body of work, you look back on it now 30 years down the line and all of it defines you. And it's the fact that you have created all of these things and gone to all of these places, and had all of these thoughts, that's what defines you.
Wow, that was really well said. I've not heard it quite put like that before. And that's very inspiring.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. So I also looked up for, just to make sure with Raptor, I wanted to get the right release dates and everything for you. So for our listeners, it is available in bookstores July 7th of next year. And I'm sorry, comic book stores July 7th and bookstores on July 20th. And it looks like we can pre-order it now. So I definitely want to make sure everyone gets on there to pre-order Raptor from Dark Horse and Dave McKean. And also you can go to davemckean.com if you want to learn more about him. And you've got a lot of great stuff on your website. I saw also your collection Nitrate, which you did inspired by the silent film posters, which I think is just fantastic. That's incredible. How did you, just real quick before we go, how did you decide to focus in on that for that collection?
Well, I've been working on that for a long time. I've loved silent films, again, since I was very young. The films themselves, but the images, those sort of strange, elusive, misty, ghost-like images, really got under my skin when I was young. And I've been working it out ever since. So I've been making drawings and paintings inspired by the films that I've found over the years. I've done a lot of them and I'm still working on them. And there's an exhibition up at the moment in Tenerife of some of those paintings and drawings at Gallery Artisar. And the book, Collecting Them All, will be out next year.
Awesome. Well, you've definitely taken us on a journey with your work, and there's so many different mediums that you can find Dave McKean's work in. So I highly suggest everybody go check it out on his website. You'll find links to everything on there. And thank you so much for coming on Spoiler Country today. Absolutely. Well, you take care. Have a wonderful rest of your day. And again, thank you so much. Come back anytime.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Where?
Back.
We should work on our timing for that, make it more fluid and seamless.
right? Because we don't do enough of that kind of stuff.
I know, right? We're not like in sync.
So what'd you think?
I'm a huge fan of his work. I mean, it was funny because one of the questions I asked Melissa to ask on this one was about the fish in Mirror Mask. Because when I was at Comic-Con back in 2004, or whatever it was, the year before Mirror Mask came out, I went to a panel with Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean talking about this movie Mirror Mask, because I was, I'm a big fan of Neil Gaiman, big fan of Dave McKean. And in it, I just distinctly remember him talking about the fish in the movie and how he personally
painted
or hand drew or something the fish.
What movie?
Mirror Mask.
Mirror Mask. Okay.
It was written by Neil Gaiman, directed by Dave McKean.
Oh, nice.
Right. And there's a couple of scenes where there's just like fish flying around in the background. It's a very surreal movie because it's Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean. And I remember him talking about the fish and how he, in my recollection, talked about how he went through and all the fish were hand done by him and on every painstakingly on every panel. But when Melissa asked him about it, he was like, no, I never said that. So which I was like, wait, no, you did. I swear I remember this, but maybe I'm misremembering it. But I, at the panel, I very much remember him saying that.
Maybe you're totally doing a Sinbad in the Genie movie.
I could be. I could have just.
What do they call that?
I heard it. Kazam.
No. There's the
Mandela effect.
Yeah, the Mandela effect. Like people think Mandela died in prison.
Right, but he didn't.
Right, but he didn't. Yeah, he got out of prison, became the president of South Africa, and.
Right.
Died many years later.
The Berenstein and Berenstein Bears.
Yeah. That's kind of weird too, the way it's written.
Yeah, because I always thought it was IEIN, not AIN.
Yeah, it's the Berenstain, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. So maybe you did that. Maybe you did the Mandela effect on it.
To myself, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, that's kind of funny. And he was like, no.
He was like, no, that's dumb. Like, oh, well, okay, sorry. I felt bad because I told him, we have to ask him about this.
Melissa.
Not on purpose. I'm sorry, Melissa.
You've been hazed.
Right. Welcome to the club.
You passed.
Oh, man.
Well, there you guys go. Dave McKean sitting down with Melissa. I hope you enjoyed that. Kind of give you an insight of who and what Dave McKean's all about. And if you enjoyed that and want to hear more from some amazing people throughout all walks of industry and life, then I highly implore you to go check out spoilerverse.com. I think looking back through our back issues, you're going to be shocked and awed by the caliber of people that we have on. And just, we run the gambit from independents that have amazing books that you should know about to everything in between.
And more. Yeah. And we have other podcasts up there like Bridging the Geekdoms and Funny Book Forensics and tons more you can go check out, and Nerds from the Crypt as well. And you can go check those out and listen to their back issues. And we have articles and reviews and previews and stuff coming out every day for you to go check out. And we have a store where you can buy a t-shirt, a face mask, or a hoodie and look fly as hell, which is awesome because when you do that, you not only do you look cool, but you also help us out and help get this going on. And, you know, we also have a Discord server. You can go to scpod.us/Discord, join our public Discord server, and come chat with us. Now, I know I said in my first episode that we're going to be doing some giveaways. We have not finally figured out how we're doing the giveaways. We're going to be starting doing the packages. We're doing some mystery box packages for giveaways. So we're getting all those packed up, and then we're going to start dropping out the details of how we're going to do giveaways. But if you want the frontline information of how to get into that, come join our Discord server and we can chat with you and you get all the details on there. Once again, that is scpod.us/Discord to come chat with us and find out about all of our cool giveaways that we're going to be working on coming soon. Both books and stuff that we can be shipped to you and digital stuff as well. We're doing both and it's going to be awesome. So you definitely want to go. Once again, scpod.us/Discord.
In an oceans of podcasts, we are Cthulhu. As Cthulhu compels you to do, open the mind.